This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sianne Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I'm Anne Applebaum from the Legarten Institute, and I'm speaking today to Anton Shekhovsov, who is the author of our new paper, Is Transition Reversible? An investigation into some of the good things and bad things about democracy in Central Europe. Anton, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for this talk.
Yes, thank you. I'm wondering if we could begin by talking about patterns. Your report goes into very great detail, actually, particularly about four countries, about Hungary, Romania, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, with a very brief note about Poland at the end. But one of the things that happened, I think, while you were writing the paper and while we were working on it, was that it became clear that there are patterns in the region and that the growth of illiberalism or illiberal democracy or whatever expression we want to use has had certain notable, has taken similar forms in similar places. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. If you look at individual countries, you will not see those patterns. But if you compare, if you apply some methodology of comparative politics, you will see those patterns across the region. These patterns, they appear not necessarily in one time. One country may move in the direction of a liberal democracy, and then other countries may learn from that experience.
So either positively or negatively.
Yes, exactly. And I think one of the patterns, there are four or five patterns that we can distinguish here, is that very often countries begin their path to illiberalization from wiretapping. Sometimes liberal democratic politicians, pro-EU politicians, they become wiretapped, and then the leaks appear sometimes, and very often, manipulated in order to show them in a bad light. This is not necessarily connected to corruption or political corruption, but maybe some, you know, free talks in restaurants, etc., etc. So this is one pattern, and this appears, for example, in Hungary, this appears in Romania, to a certain extent, in Poland. So this is one first major pattern. The second one is that...
So you're saying that the wiretaps are done by mysterious forces, by
mysterious
secret services, it's not clear who, then they appear, and then the material is used to discredit...
Discredit pro-EU politicians. Usually pro-EU politicians. Again, these may be external forces or military intelligence. Sometimes it is clear that it was military intelligence, for example. The second pattern is that once a party acquires a constitutional majority, it usually goes for changing constitution. Mm-hmm. It tries to secure its power for a very long time, you know, for the future, not necessarily for the term that they will be in power, but also for the future. And sometimes the European Union, Brussels, tries to stop this process of changing the constitution in an illiberal way. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Hungary, for example, was quite successful in maneuvering or outmaneuvering the EU, not sanctions, but advice, for mm-hmm. example. The third pattern is that what is happening with the state media, state-owned media. A party which tries to introduce some illiberal politics, it usually starts changing the media environment and trying to put politicians from the party, members of the party, or loyal to the party, in charge of the state media, which happens quite often, because the media is a very important tool for the civil society, for example, to somehow keep these checks and balances in a country.
Can you give some examples of that in the last few years?
Again, talking about Hungary, they created several institutions that are now in charge of the state media. And we can also see that the heads of those institutions, they are appointed directly by the party, by the Fidesz, which is a ruling party in Hungary. But there are some other examples, not necessarily with the government or this ruling party changing the media environment, but patterns that I would call like Berlusconization, mm-hmm. when people in power also acquire media and quite a significant share of the national media environment, and they join politics and the media. And this is why I call it Berlusconization.
Yes, I think you speak about it in the context of the Czech Republic.
The Czech Republic, yes. And I particularly speak about Finance Minister Babiš, who is quite popular now. I'm absolutely sure that his popularity has a lot to do with the media that he acquired and started to promote himself as a politician. His party is now basically the most popular party in the Czech Republic.
It's interesting you say Berlusconization, because of course this isn't an Eastern European or Central European issue. It's something that we see in other parts of Europe, most notably in Italy, of course.
Yes, and this is a very important note, that this paper and this research is not anti-Central Europe. Mm-hmm. This is just an investigation in this region, and of course some of the patterns or some of the influences, they come from Western Europe or mm-hmm. Southern Europe, if we're talking about Silvio Berlusconi, for example. Mm-hmm. So this paper is driven by admiration for Central Europe and also concern mm-hmm. for the things that are happening there in the region.
Mm-hmm. You speak in the paper about a number of countries who struggled with illiberal politicians earlier on and somehow came out of it or emerged from it. You know, perhaps Romania. Would you like to speak of one of those examples?
Yes. If we look at the 90s and the transition process, it was very uneven in the region, mm-hmm. even in Visegrad 4 countries. Mm-hmm. Romania is not in Visegrad 4, but it really struggled in the 90s. What happened in Romania is that in 1989, after 1989, there was no... 1989 was not a revolution in Romania. It was change of the elites, but the first echelon of the Communist Party went away, but the second echelon became the ruling elite in Romania. And many practices, many policies continued under the facade of liberal democracy, mm-hmm. and it took Romania quite a long time to move away from this quite illiberal environment and start to reform. Almost 10 years.
And what were the elements that made that happen? Where did the impulse to reform come from?
In the 90s, the liberal democratic forces, pro-EU forces, they were quite disunited. They were fighting with each other, and this made the illiberal politicians so powerful. But at the same time, when the liberal democrats started to work with each other, to agree on some points, to reach some kind of a consensus, then it started to work. But also the EU prospects were very, very important for Romania. When it became clear that Romania is on the path to the membership of the EU, the society consolidated. Mm-hmm. There was also very important funding provided by the European Union for the development of the civil societies, for the NGOs, for the independent media. And this worked to the advantage of liberalization of Romanian politics. But Romania is not the only example. Take, for example, Slovakia. Slovakia was very, very far away from a liberal democracy in the 90s. Under the leadership of Vladimir Mečiar, it was a very strange case, because Slovakia was surrounded by quite robust liberal democratic countries. And it was a very strange example of illiberalism, you know, inside quite a liberal democratic region. And it also took them a while for Slovakia to consolidate. And they were not even invited, like all the other countries in the region, to join the EU, for example. They applied, but at the end of the 90s, nobody even talked that Slovakia may become a member of the EU. But then again, liberal democratic forces consolidated, started to reform the country, very successful reforms, actually. And they received the invitation and they joined, like all the other, like many countries in the region in 2004, and also the NATO, which was quite important.
So, you know, so what we've actually seen over the last 25 years is countries moving back and forward.
Yes, and then you have very quite sad examples, I even say, with Hungary and the Czech Republic and now Poland, that were quite robust democracies in the 90s. And nobody could have thought at that time that the developments would be quite frightening, in a sense, what is happening now in those countries.
Right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how frightening they become. One of the other things you speak about is the growth of uncivil society or kind of illiberal speech in this part of the world, which you hint at. I mean, I don't think you really lay it out in this paper, but it's clear. Hint at is partly inspired by Russia, that there's a part of the media, particularly a part of the online and electronic media, which pushes very hard anti-EU, anti-NATO, anti-democratic ideas. I mean, it's had some traction in the region, which is one of the things I think that makes this region different from some others.
Exactly. And I think that this is also one of the patterns of illiberalization in the region. And I think it is quite dangerous because this pattern, the development of the uncivil society, it has to do with culture. Parties come and go. Prime ministers or presidents, they come and go, but culture stays. So what is happening is that there is a proliferation of illiberal ideas in the online media and the so-called alternative media now. Mm-hmm. And they change the culture. In the 90s, even in the beginning of the noughties, this illiberal culture was a marginal one. It was a subculture.
Like it is everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, you had all those websites with the very bad design speaking about conspiracy theories, etc., etc.
In every country. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And now it is becoming mainstream. Mm. And sometimes you sense that it is coming from Russia, mm-hmm. especially with the admiration of coming from Russia for conspiracy theories or anti-EU, anti-NATO narratives. But some of them are homegrown. Mm-hmm. And in Slovakia, in the Czech Republic, you can see that those conspiracy theories, they help illiberal politicians to not only to stay in power, but develop this culture that helps them to stay in power, where those magazines and online media, they would be promoting traditionalism in the sense of not doing any reform.
At the very end of the paper, you speak a little bit about what might be done about it from outside. I mean, obviously, in each one of these countries, the most important drivers of action are the people themselves and the politicians themselves. And there's, you know, the outside world has only limited impact, there as in any other sovereign country. But you do make some suggestions about how international institutions and other countries might think about helping democracy in the region. And you argue that sort of hand-wringing and, you know, big criticism and so on might backfire. But you have some other thoughts.
Yes, this is quite important, what you said about backfiring. We have an example from Austria in 2001, mm-hmm. when the Conservative Party, the People's Party of Austria, formed a governing coalition with the far-right party, Freedom Party of Austria. And there were sanctions against Austria, not from the European side, not from the EU, but from individual states. Mm-hmm. And they basically cut diplomatic relations with Austria. But those sanctions, they only lasted for 6 months. because it started to backfire, because Euroscepticism started to develop even further in Austria, mm-hmm. and European countries understood that they might be doing even worse mm-hmm. for Austria. So the first suggestion is to exercise caution. We cannot call for the EU to put sanctions on any country. And even if there is an institutional design for those sanctions that can be found in the Treaty of the European Union, it is better to first to communicate, which is very, very important. And one suggestion is to try to, for the EU and NATO as well, to try to communicate more to the public in those countries. Because sometimes the EU and NATO, they lack communication. There is more EU in conspiracy theories across the region than in reality. Mm-hmm. There should be more EU, there should be more communication explaining. Because for some people, EU is some kind of a, you know, Brussels monster that is somewhere there dictating its politics for the sovereign country.
And not only in Central Europe is this a problem.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I know how sensitive this issue here in this country. Mm-hmm. And so there's this. Then it is very, very obvious that Russia is benefiting from the illiberalization in Central Europe. Mm-hmm. And one of the tools is the energy politics of Russia. Mm-hmm. Which it has been going on from the 90s, obviously. But now, since Russia started to implement more aggressive policies, now it's becoming more and more dangerous for the Central European country to be so dependent on energy from Russia, from imports from Russia. So it should be made clear that the EU has to do something. It has to propose some reforms in the energy sector. And especially, it has to talk to Russia as the main exporter of natural gas for the EU, to talk as one voice, one European voice, rather than leaving those countries to deal with Russia on the individual level.
Yes, this is the argument for an EU energy union or a common energy policy.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the media. You see, the EU has to develop new frameworks for the media, for training journalists on the national level. All those training programs that worked in the 90s, they don't work anymore because media environment has changed. Now, internet has become maybe even more important for people, you know, on the everyday level than the printed magazines and printed newspapers. Now we have very active social media, Facebook, Twitter.
And most people get their information that way.
Exactly. And with Facebook and Twitter and all those social media, it is, you no longer distinguish between real information or fact and some fiction and fake information. It just, they are absolutely equal on your Twitter friends page, or you know, what you see. This is all the same information, and people start. And this is how uncivil society develops. When people no longer distinguish between fact and fiction, and started believing various conspiracy theories. So these are things that may be useful for the EU and NATO to consider.
So a kind of needing to rethink the media environment and ways in which, ways in which fact-checking and, you know, fact-based websites and fact-based institutions can be somehow supported. Yeah. We're working on that here. We have a long-term project looking at how to do that, or what kinds of things work. As you know, it's not simple.
Yes, and again, this is not only for Central Europe.
No, of course not.
The most recent developments in Germany, for example, how absolutely fictionous and fake information about the Russian girl being kidnapped and molested by the immigrants how this fake was born in mythology and how it was transmitted via Russian TV channels, and that became a problem for the German society, because that gave energy to the far right organizations in Germany, mm-hmm. and fact checking is becoming a security issue,
yes.
and also corruption in the EU. That's also, it's a very important security issue. It's no longer just a matter of individual politicians or individual countries. This is a problem for the whole region, for the whole EU.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We appreciate you writing the paper, and I hope readers will download it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.